One of the biggest challenges a new doctor faces comes right at the beginning. Medical school.
That's 4 years of nothing but learning from sun up to sundown and sometimes well after sundown.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about learning with a doctor who changed from a traditional to an alternative approach. We'll also meet the new leader of a literacy program, grow a summer school garden, and spend an academic minute at the farmer's market. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Last summer, we talked about the classic book Lies My Teacher Told Me, so I perked up a bit when I came across a new book called Lies My Doctor Told Me. Dr. Ken Berry runs a small clinic in rural Tennessee. Well, he did. The clinic recently burned to the ground and is currently being rebuilt, so Dr. Berry has some time to promote his new book. He's practiced family medicine for a decade and has moved to a more alternative approach to medicine and nutrition. We recently got together to talk about his book and the current state of medical education in the U.S. We started with the title of the book and its similarity to Lies My Teacher Told Me.
I actually love that book and read it years and years ago, and I loosely modeled my book on that book because I loved it so much.
So that book was pretty much a history book. Your book is pretty much a nutrition book.
Yeah, nutrition and medicine and basically the care and feeding of a human animal.
So how annoyed are other doctors with you?
Slightly, I guess. Most doctors are so busy they don't really have time to look up. We spend most of our time reading the medical literature within our specialty. Very often, or very seldom, do we read outside of our specialty, much less out of the medical box at all. So I suspect many doctors don't know about my book at all. But when they do find out about it, they might be slightly annoyed.
Go back to the beginning in medical school. Medical school is such an intense time in a new doctor's life, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And so many people consider their doctor to be closed-minded and not open to new ideas. But what I think they should realize is that in order to get into and through medical school, you have to be a student. You have to be a vociferous reader and learner. You have to be eager to learn new things, because that's 4 years of nothing but learning from sun up to sundown, and sometimes well after sundown, you continue to learn in medical school. And so, yeah, medical school is by far the largest academic challenge I ever faced.
Once you're out of medical school, is the way medical practice set up in the U.S. right now conducive to continued learning?
It's conducive to a sort of pseudo-continued learning. And so what most doctors wind up doing is reading all of the latest publications about new drug studies, which are often funded by the drug companies themselves, often conducted by the drug companies themselves. And so what you wind up with is a very partitioned knowledge. And so you quickly lose the big picture as a doctor if you're reading the medical journals you're expected to read and not much else. Only by reading outside of that medical box do you have any hope of having a circumspect view of medicine and nutrition and overall health in general. If you just read the medical literature that you're expected to read and nothing else, you quickly become jaded and depressed because none of your patients are getting better, and your one and only job is to keep adding medications to their regimen. That's really all you wind up doing if you just stay in your little medical box.
Where can a doctor, do doctors know where to find, quote unquote, the good information?
No, there's really no roadmap for a doctor. You have to You have to, first of all, formulate a question in your mind. Wonder why all of my patients are obese, even though I'm recommending the American Diabetes Association diet and the American Heart Association diet and the Weight Watchers and Jenny Craig and Biggest Loser. I'm recommending all these diets, yet all of my patients continue to become more and more obese. Wonder why that is. And when a doctor formulates a question like that in his mind, then he starts looking outside of his box, because he quickly finds that there's no answer in within medical practice for that question. That question really is frowned upon. You don't even really want to ask that question. That's outside your pay grade, so to speak. But I feel like that most doctors took an oath, and they meant that oath, and they still believe in that oath. And in order to practice with reverence to that oath, you've got to read outside your specialty and even read outside traditional medicine. And most doctors don't do that, and I wish there were a roadmap, and I guess they could follow me if they'd like a rough pathway of how to do that.
How do you know you're following the right stuff?
Yeah, you don't, and that's the problem. You suspected that you were following the right directions to my condo today, but you didn't know until you got here. And I think that's the way of all paths that humans take. We suspect it's the right road. We hope it's the right road, but we never really know until the end.
So how do you know you're following the right information?
I don't. All I can do is do the best that I can. And so I get lots of anecdotal evidence that I'm following the right pathway, because I have patients now who were formerly morbidly obese who are no longer morbidly obese. I have patients who used to be type 2 diabetics and their diabetes was severely uncontrolled in spite of multiple medications. And now their type 2 diabetes is either reversed or in remission, depending on semantics. I have patients now who have very healthy livers, even though a few years ago they had severe fatty liver, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. All of their liver labs were elevated. Now their livers are back to normal. And so I have that kind of evidence in hundreds of different patients that tends to make me believe that I'm moving in the right direction.
And without getting into specifics, because, you know, there's a book out there with this stuff in it, you do go outside the, you know, what you'd expect a doctor to tell you what to eat.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, everything that the traditionally trained medical doctor would tell you to eat, those things are going to directly contribute to your increasing morbidity and mortality. They're going to make you more obese. They're going to make your blood sugar and your serum insulin levels chronically elevated. They're going to begin the deposition of fat in your liver. All these things are very, very unhealthy and lead to all the chronic diseases that we currently have epidemics of in the United States.
You do talk about how our ancestors ate. Well, our ancestors died at 30.
They did die at 30 on average, but that was because of a sky-high infant mortality rate. That was also because of sky-high rates of infection and trauma. And actually, once you control, if one of our ancestors 100,000 years ago made it through the first few years of childhood and didn't fall off a cliff or get eaten by a saber tooth or didn't develop some infection and die from that, they actually lived into their 70s and 80s. It was very commonplace for them to make it until their seventh or eighth decade of life if they made it past those early hurdles in life. And so a lot of people will say that, you know, they died at 30. Actually, that's the average lifespan back then, and if you control for the deaths early in life, they actually live to be as old as we do now.
At the end of the book, you do go through little lies, just the very little lies, and some of them, you know, don't go swimming after eating. Well, we all know that one, but do people really believe that stuff?
Oh, some doctors actually believe the little lies, and that's actually a very fun chapter of the book. I enjoyed putting that together. For instance, you know, cutting your hair will make it grow faster. There are many people, even cosmetologists, who believe that's an absolute fact. Nothing could be further from truth. You know, your hair's dead. It doesn't know what you're doing to the tip of it. The only living cells are in your scalp. And so that also speaks directly to multi-million dollar industries that will trick you into thinking that if you wash your hair with a certain shampoo or you put a certain this or that or the other on the surface, surface of your hair, it will somehow make it healthier or make it grow faster or make it do other things. And so there's only a very, very few things that you can put on your scalp that will make your hair grow or make your hair healthier. 99% of the other things are just a waste of money. But that little lie speaks to that much bigger lie.
Yeah, that almost got you hit by a textbook.
Exactly. Yeah, multiple chapters in my book might get a textbook thrown at me if the wrong person read that chapter.
Finally, what do you got against Nick Cage?
I don't have a thing against Nicolas Cage. I think he's a great actor. And so if people will understand the difference between correlation and causation, if you understand the meaning of those two words, and many doctors do not, which is very scary. I mean, I don't expect my mechanic or my hairdresser or my grocery store manager to understand the difference between causation and correlation, but I do expect doctors to understand it. But you can look at their prescribing practices and realize very quickly they don't understand the difference between those two words. What you're alluding to is a chapter in the book talking about correlation and causation, where there's a direct correlation between the release of a new Nicolas Cage movie and home swimming pool drownings. Now, if you just look at the graph, you think, well, God, Nicolas Cage is killing people, right? But that's obviously, that's an error in your logic. There's a correlation, and it's actually a very tight correlation, but it's meaningless. There's no causation there. One does not cause the other in either direction. But many doctors will look at a graph given to them by a drug company representative, and they'll see the correlation between two different lines on the graph, and immediately they'll say, oh, there you go, I need to prescribe this pill. And that is a terrible error in logic and in just a basic understanding of statistics, but it's something that happens in doctor's offices every single day.
So I guess finally I'll ask you this. I imagine people would call what you practice alternative medicine. Do we know, like, supplementation or stuff like that? Is that worth a darn?
Yeah. So what I consider my practice to be is kind of a hybrid model between traditional medicine and alternative medicine, and then just the proper human diet. And when you combine those three things, I think that's the most powerful place to practice medicine. If you have broken a bone, or if you have appendicitis, or if you have acute heart failure, you need traditional medicine. You need the intensive care unit. You need the emergency department. You need all those things, and those are wonderful things to have available. If, however, you've been chronically poisoning yourself with the standard American diet, traditional medicine has very little to offer you. The theories in alternative medicine can be quite helpful in really truly understanding the care and feeding of the human animal, but unfortunately, many alternative care practitioners promote a full line of very expensive nutraceuticals and other supplements, 99% of which I consider to be completely worthless. They're not worth the money, but their profit margin depends on you buying this line of supplements. Therefore, they will tell you this line of supplements is very important. If you eat the proper human diet, almost every single supplement becomes unnecessary. And then finally, the most important thing in human health, in my opinion, the bedrock of human health is nutrition. If you eat a proper human diet, you won't develop type 2 diabetes. You won't become obese. You won't develop fatty liver. You won't have any of the other of the chronic disease epidemics that all of our friends and family members are suffering from. You just won't have those things, and then you'll have no need for either traditional or alternative medicine.
Again, the name of Dr. Ken Berry's book is Lies My Doctor Told Me, Medical Myths That Can Harm Your Health. Still to come, a literacy program for young students in Massachusetts has a new leader. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A nationally recognized child literacy program in Western Massachusetts has a new leader. Chrissy Howard will run the Springfield City Library's Reading Success by Fourth Grade initiative. The library assumed management of the program earlier this year from the Davis Foundation. The effort began in 2009 to raise the level of third grade reading proficiency in the city's public schools, which at the time was only 28%. The Best of Our Knowledge's Paul Tuthill spoke with Chrissy Howard.
I'm a Springfield resident, and I've worked in Springfield Public Schools as an instructional coach, instructional leadership specialist of literacy, and I've worked a lot in formal public education. I was a head of school in Worcester. I've worked as a teacher and a coach and in the principal role, and I really feel like the structures of school are kind of set, and all the schools are doing everything they can to get all kids reading, and that's really important, but there's so much of a child's day that is outside of the classroom, and I was very interested in working with the community to try to figure out how we can work together to increase just literacy all over, but to honor families' multi-literacies and to work specifically with this initiative. The early childhood experience is really important. We know that the reading levels or being able to read on grade level by the end of third grade is a huge indicator of long-term success in school, graduating, being prepared for college, career, active citizenship, all those things, which is really giving all of the Springfield kids an opportunity to be able to do whatever they want. That's kind of the point, is to give them choice in doing whatever they want for their lives. And to do that, you need to be able to be reading and have access to these other opportunities. So I know that Davis Foundation and the library, both institutions, have been champions of early literacy and building collaboration. So I'm hopeful that this is really going to make a big impact in the city.
This initiative, which you now mm-hmm. manage, is, as you indicated, started about 10 years ago by the mm-hmm. Davis Foundation with the library and the public schools and others as, mm-hmm. as partners. Have you had a chance to assess what has occurred in those 10 years, where things stand now as you take over the management responsibility?
Yeah, so that's actually where I'm starting. I'm only in my third week here, and I'm starting with a listening tour. I've received lists of over 100 partners of individuals, community members, organizations, the public schools, the library, like you said, and so many other groups of people, coalitions and committees and convenings and councils and everyone who has really played a major role or even a minor role in the work that's being done in Springfield to increase early literacy rates. And what I'm doing is I'm going out meeting folks and just saying hi and kind of just listening and taking stock of, like, what are the accomplishments? How were we able to work together in the past 10 years? How have they been involved, and would they like to remain involved? What are the hopes and dreams of the collaboration of by working together? What do we hope to help each other do? So far, everyone who is been involved, wants to continue to be involved at varying levels, and everyone is very excited to continue the momentum of what's been going on. This initiative taking over is really big shoes to fill. They've been an All-American City, they've been Pacesetter Community, they've been honored by the National Campaign for Grade Level Reading, so there's a lot of work that's been done, and I want to continue that momentum, and I want to get everyone's input. And I think it's really important that everyone have a seat at this table.
Sure. I mean, the initiative is described as encompassing a community-wide strategy. Mm-hmm. I mean, but in listening to some of the partners that you've been meeting or planning to meet with, it almost sounds do you feel like it's a little bit too unwieldy?
Right now, I think that everyone is behind this mission of battling generational poverty, ensuring all of Springfield's kids have access to economic opportunity. I think that everyone's behind those big issues. I think that there's a lot of places to grow and to work together. You know, you're right. There's 10 years of history here. That's a lot going on. And moving forward, I'd love to convene the partners that are interested and bring everybody together at the table and say, you know, where is our focus going to be? And so that's, too, is my next step. Actually, I'm on this listening tour now, and I'm hoping to have a convening in the fall where we come together and we think about, you know, what are the next logical and hopeful steps and build a real strategy, you know, involving the community and our advisory boards and all these different organizations that really have a lot of great ideas that we'd like to put together and kind of bring some focus in so that, you know, by fall, winter, that we have a really some strategy, some action steps, and we know where we're going and we know how to get there, but also what it looks like when we get there and how we can measure our progress.
So what will define success for you then?
Right now, I just like to meet everybody.
Okay. So,
and I think.
But is there a specific target for third grade reading proficiency that you're looking for? I according to the most recent test results that we have available, it currently is at 44%.
I think that there's been so much success, that so much has been done, and I'm very proud to be able to continue this work, but that we also do have a lot of work to do, that 44% of students passing the state assessment, that's majority failing, and we need to work on that. So much has been done already, and I'm just excited to close that gap and really get to having all of our kids be successful.
Chrissy Howard is the new manager of the Springfield, Massachusetts City Library's Reading Success by Fourth Grade initiative. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Paul Tuttle. More and more schools in the U.S. are starting school gardens, offering educators a chance to teach students about math and science through a hands-on experience. But as those involved can relate, growing fruits and veggies isn't child's play. Payne Roberts reports for Harvest Public Media on the challenges associated with sustaining a school garden.
In Lawrence, Kansas, asparagus is a hot commodity.
The demand for asparagus was and it continues to be very, very strong.
That's John Pendleton. Adorned in a matching green hat and apron, he's selling homegrown produce at the Clinton Parkway Nursery Farmers Market in Lawrence. Pendleton's Country Market is a staple at area farmers markets and has been selling locally grown food for more than 30 years.
Thanks for coming out today.
Several stands down, the competition. Three middle school students are selling potatoes, cucumbers, and an array of herbs that were all grown in their school garden. Perry Kennard, a seventh grade science teacher at Southwest Junior High in Lawrence, oversees this garden. It's their second summer in the market, but this year they tried something new, asparagus.
We're hoping to expand the variety that we can offer and the experience that we have for our kids and for our community.
So is there an asparagus war boiling in Kansas? Pendleton says no. The school gardens won't really harm his business, but he has felt an impact.
A particular restaurant might not be taking that much stuff, but if you take three or four restaurants and pool it together, then it makes it worthwhile to make a delivery. And if all of a sudden they're buying from the kids because it's the politically correct thing to do, then, you know, we maybe have lost a market that way.
Unexpected competition is one challenge communities must face when it comes to school gardens. The number of these projects in the U.S. has exploded in popularity over the past decade. That's according to the National Farm to School Network. These programs typically operate by student and volunteer labor with funding from donations and grants. Most often, the produce is used in school cafeterias, but because the growing season doesn't coincide with the school year, the question of how to most effectively use school gardens in the summertime is often a concern. Here's Pendleton again.
They start off with saying, yeah, we can run it through the school kitchens and things like that, but when you realize that the majority of the produce that they raise isn't during the school year.
To curb the amount of produce sold at the farmers market, Southwest Junior High offers a CSA program for parents and faculty, and it donates some food to the school cafeteria. However, because the growing season peaks during the summertime, less than 10% of that food is served at the school. Summertime also causes difficulty when it comes to enlisting labor assistance, leaving the work to volunteers and teachers.
One of the advantages of being a teacher is that you have your summers off. Well, I don't have my summers off anymore.
And that burden isn't reduced once the school year returns, as teachers then must cultivate their gardens and their students.
Listen, it's very easy to get into this well-intended but not understand the amount of labor involved.
That's Stephen Ritz, a teacher and administrator from the South Bronx who advocates nationwide for school gardens. He recently came to Lawrence to offer advice for community members who are interested in sustaining its school gardens. Ritz said school gardens are more successful today because educators tie them to academics. as compared to the traditional model, where gardens were used as an excuse to move classes outdoors in pleasant weather.
Now we're talking about percent germination. We're talking about reading. We're talking about writing. We're talking about documenting the process. We're talking about math. We're talking about making connections. We're talking about the whole process, as opposed to just being out there and digging in the dirt.
The National Farm to School Network expects the number of school gardens to increase. For now, there appears to be plenty of room for them at farmers markets as the market for locally grown food increases. But as any gardener can attest, overcrowding can stunt growth. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Payne Roberts.
If growing a garden's not in your future, you can always head to a nearby farmers market, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Are farmers markets achieving their goals? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Justin Shoup, assistant professor of sociology, looks into whether they are getting healthy food to those who need it.
Participation in the local food movement has grown dramatically in the United States, with the farmers market being one of its most widespread and heavily promoted forums. Proponents argue that farmers markets not only support local food systems, but also strengthen community and make healthy food available to people who might otherwise not have access to it. My analysis of nearly 6,000 farmers markets across the United States found that, at present, the reality of the movement falls short of its many promises towards improving access to healthy food, but it also found cause for optimism. For the past several years, I've been studying farmers markets, where they are located, how they operate, and who they serve. As you might expect, mapping the location of farmers markets and analyzing the characteristics of neighborhoods that host markets revealed that most are in spaces with higher than average socioeconomic characteristics, higher than average white residents, and overwhelmingly located in urban areas. But the data contains surprises, too. For example, though overwhelmingly located in well-to-do areas, when compared to surrounding neighborhoods, market areas were more likely to have residents who were doing poorly economically. The use of public assistance programs was significantly higher in neighborhoods with farmers markets, too. Lastly, in some areas of the country, a significant portion of markets were located in neighborhoods made up of residents who were exclusively racial and ethnic minorities. Based on the data, farmers and farmers markets could be moving closer to addressing some issues of food access. However, work still remains. Continued experimentation, such as rethinking the types of produce and products sold, involving interested communities in market development, and increasing food assistance credits to be used for purchasing food at markets could be ways to promote a more inclusive market session. Such strategies may help farmers markets broaden their reach to underserved populations.
That was Justin Shoup of Wheaton College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.